Jacob, I'm an alcoholic. That was like the best introduction I've ever had. Thank you so much. Serious, that was beautiful. I'm going to share something that I'm shameful of from last night with everybody here. I ate a tally-ho sober. Because everybody said that you eat there when you're drunk. So I did it sober, and I survived. We have a place like that in Baton Rouge called Louie's. It's open 24 hours a day. And it's like off of Skid Row, kind of, in the hood. And, yeah, it's pretty good food. So I'm going to tell you all in a general way of what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Before I get into that, I have some house cleaning items to get to. I've been talking to Chris for about a year and a half, it seems, about this conference. He's the chair for this conference. He's done an outstanding job. And the entire host committee, everybody that's involved, I've been a part of these before. I know the work that goes into it. So I want to give your recognition for that, all the hard work that y'all have done. Again, my host Brandon, that's done an amazing job. He's fed me multiple times. We went ate. I had two entrees at the Italian restaurant yesterday because I didn't know if I wanted manicotti or pizza because I'm indecisive. So I had both. It was great. But I gave up sugar for Lent because I gorged myself on king cakes for like 30 days straight and had 17 king cakes in 30 days because that's the type of person I am. Mardi Gras was last Tuesday, so the sugar purge is going well. The headaches are becoming less and less every day, you know. The gift basket, again, the hospitality, Brandon talked about it. I mean, everybody that I've met, it's like I've known you my whole life. The format for the conference with the fellowship, speed fellowship, we've done that before. You have to interact with everybody. So after I'm done on the bingo card sheet, signature from a speaker or panelist, come see me after the meeting. I'd love to meet you, and I'll sign your paperwork. Like a meeting attendance sheet, right. And all the speakers and the panelists, whenever I found out Laura was going to be speaking, I got really excited because she's a dear friend of mine. I go to, she's from Marble Falls, Texas. And I go there every Christmas, and I got to go there last spring. If you're ever in the Texas area, Marble Falls is probably the most beautiful place in all of Texas in the Hill Country. If you go in April, you will see so many blue bonnets and wildflowers. It is picturesque. So if you ever have the opportunity to go, I recommend that time. She can attest to that. And my beautiful wife for allowing me to participate in this. She's back home taking care of my boys. And that's a very, very tough job at times. 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. So she's a saint for that and allowing me to do this and travel. So again, like I said, I'm going to tell you in a general way of what I used to be like, what happened, and what I am like now. It is life. It doesn't change. As a result of working the 12 steps, I change. My reaction to life changes. The way I view life changes. I have a sobriety date of April the 2nd of 2006. I'm 38 years old. I'm no longer considered a young person in AA, which it says on the little thing, but I did get sober young. I got sober whenever I was 20. And I came in AA whenever I was 16 in 2001. I have a home group. It's called Circle Triangle Group on Wednesdays in Lafayette, Louisiana. It's a closed literature study. Women are invited to come, but it's all men that show up. So I don't know. But you're invited if you're ever around. Everybody. We read the 12 and 12. It's a mixture of different backgrounds, political, ethnic, religious, but we all mix. And it's an intimate group of individuals that I get to share personal details about my life with. And I need that. It's more than a meeting. It's a fellowship. And I have a sponsor. I just recently transitioned from Oklahoma, the Midwest, back to Louisiana. It's totally different places, by the way. And I have a sponsor in Oklahoma whenever I was living there named Tony P. He's a Cajun that got lost along the way somewhere around Shreveport. He just doesn't know it. He's an Oklahoma Sooners fan. And I wear this tie for him every time because it's an LSU tie. and he hates it. And I have a sponsor in Louisiana named Greg. I sponsor a couple guys. We meet every Sunday. I'm an active participant in Alcoholics Anonymous in my home group and in the fellowship. So I think the most important information that we can have in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always like to start with that, is the very beginning of the big book. It's the forward to the first edition. I'm a big book guy, so brace yourself. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So it says something without saying that if you're an alcoholic like I was, you want to get recovered, read this book. And if we read this book, it shows us precisely in detail how to get recovered. Recovered from what? What's that mean? What's that look like? I recover from a hopeless condition of mind and body. The mind is the obsession that occurs before I put the first one in me. It's insane idea, thought, alibi, or excuse that makes me ready for me to do the first one. I love her, I hate her, I got hired, I got fired. I'm just going to take the edge off. I'm just going to do one. I give in the insane idea, I put the first one in me, and after that, the phenomenon of craving happens, and I have an allergic reaction. And I'm like Pac-Man, I want more and more and more and more and more until I physically cannot put any more into my body. I black out, I pass out, I say I'm never doing this again. The guilt, the shame, the remorse, consequences usually keep me dry for about 3 weeks, maybe a month. And the insane idea comes back in my mind saying it's going to be different this time. Y'all relate with that? Yeah. I've recovered from that. That no longer exists for me, and it hasn't for a very, very long time, but what I have is life. And I thought for a long time that if I got sober, once I got sober, life would change. But life doesn't change, I change. As a result of going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the way I react and the way I view life has changed drastically. I go through divorce or bankruptcy or cancer. I fall in love. I fall out of love. I rode in Mardi Gras sober. I go to tailgates. I go to concerts. I go to music festivals. I lost my father sober. I lost an unborn daughter sober. I married my wife sober. We have two beautiful boys sober. Good, bad, or indifferent, whatever happened in my life, not only have I not drank over it, I haven't even thought about drinking over it. And that's what recovery looks like to me. To be able to handle life successfully, not only thought after my part naturally, you know? So I'm the youngest of seven. I have three brothers and three sisters. Nice Catholic family, right? And my mom is bipolar, schizophrenic, manic, depressive, alcoholic. It's a combo, right? I know. My dad was a workaholic politician slash oilman, oil field. And my dad worked a lot. My mom would drink heavy, heavy liquor with her sedatives or her psychotropic medication. So her medication didn't work very well whenever she would drink alcohol with it. So she would have a lot of episodes, panic attacks, nervous breakdowns, psych wards, physical altercations with my older brothers and sisters. And I'm the youngest. I was very, very small. And when things kind of got crazy at my house, they dropped me off at a lady that pretty much raised me. And took me in as her own. She was almost 100 years old when she passed away. She was an African-American lady named Miseta. And she instilled in me a lot of beliefs, morals, values, ideas. She loved me unconditionally. She was a godsend, really. A long time ago, whenever I went through the 12-step process, I was doing some amends, and I reached out to my mom. And I told her that I forgave her for everything that she had did growing up. And I loved her no matter what. And when she heard that, she started to break down. She cried. She cried hysterically, actually. Because today I know that my mom did the best job that she was capable of doing at that time. She wasn't a well person. She was a sick person. And she was incapable of being a very good mother in that point, you know. And she had been waiting her entire life just to hear one of her kids say that. I'm the only sober member of all of my siblings. All of my siblings are 40s and 50 years old, and they're sitting on the porch at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and they're drinking alcohol, and they're blaming my mom for their problems still. And I used to be like that, and I don't do that anymore. I took control, and I took ownership of my own alcoholism, and they refused to do that, you know? So growing up in that environment, and with Miseta, you always hear the analogy of being a square peg in a round hole and not fitting and all that stuff. Well, I was a square peg in a round hole because I was a white kid at the gospel church. But the reality is physically I looked different, but I felt nothing but love and compassion and understanding. But it also made me unique because I stood out and all the other kids were interested in me because I was different, you know? And you know, customary in Louisiana, you go to crawfish boils or seafood boils, and where I grew up, 60 miles southwest of New Orleans, in the, yeah, there is a south of New Orleans, it's the swamps, that's where I grew up. It's there's a popular TV show called Swamp People, that's where I grew up, yeah. Dudum, yeah, that guy, that, yeah, that's like 20 minutes away, it really did. And Coach O from LSU, yeah, like 30 minutes away. So it's customary in Louisiana, you know, crawfish boils and seafood boils, you drink alcohol, you drink beer, right? And it was, you know, you go pick a beer for your dad, you get a little pool, you know, but the first time alcohol worked for me was whenever I was 12. Gin and juice, Mad Dog 2020. They don't have that in Canada. I told that story in Canada one time. They're like, what? You know, it's probably the metric system or something. I don't know. But I drank that stuff down. I blacked out that night. I woke up the next mid-morning. I was like, my friends were there. I was like, who spilled rice and gravy? That's not rice and gravy. You got sick and all this stuff. And I don't remember anything that happened that night, but I hear something very, very clearly. I remember something very, very clearly. It was whenever I took a sip of that alcohol, that gin, and I took another sip, and I took another sip, and this warm wave came over me. I once heard a speaker describe the feeling I got from that as, y'all understand what I'm talking about whenever I say that, right? The hard drinker or the non-alcoholic doesn't have that feeling, you know. The Big Book describes it as a complete psychic change. I had a complete psychic change whenever I put alcohol into my body. I wasn't a short bucktooth kid with freckles anymore. I could talk to girls, I could dance, I felt comfortable in my own skin. All that stuff that was going on with my mom and my family was just non-existent. I felt like I had the weight of the world wrapped around me in a lead coat, and for the first time in my life I was able to let it down and I was able to be comfortable, you know. It just released for me. And I didn't drink every single day after that. I drank when it was readily available. And kind of like Laura was talking about, it was like on the weekends. And then the weekends became Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And then, you know, it just progressively got worse over time. I didn't have any consequences whenever I was 12, 13, 14, 15, because I was walking around the neighborhood. But whenever I turned 16 years old is whenever everything changed for me, because I got a driver's license at 16, and I'm not proud to admit this, but I like to drink and I like to drive. And I like to do it, like, often, all the time, you know? And I'm lucky I never killed anybody as a result of my drinking and my driving. But even at 16 years old, I had been on a bender, and I'm driving over to high school one morning, and I reached for something behind the seat. It was marijuana. I reached back there, and whenever I turned around, there was a girl crossing the crosswalk, and I ran her over. I ran over her left foot, her head smashed my windshield, and I fractured her elbow on the right side of the mirror. And even at 16 years old, as selfish and self-centered as I was, it was a crossing guard's fault that day. It was the traffic. It was the fog. It was her for not looking both ways and being more cautious. It was everybody's fault but my own. I couldn't take responsibility for my own actions even at 16 years old. I am an alcoholic, and I believe in the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, but sedatives are a part of my story, and I want to be clear about that, because I like the effect produced by alcohol, but it just didn't work fast enough for me. I like to reach oblivion as quickly as possible, and whatever allowed me to do that, I did it, you know? Later that year, after that incident, probably 3 or 4 months later, I ended up going to a house party, and on the way to this house party, there's a residential neighborhood that they were building. And they had a drawbridge over this pond. And I remember sitting down on this drawbridge with a friend of mine next to me. And we opened up a bottle and I just blacked out. I don't remember anything. And I woke up the next day and I was in a room full of people I vaguely recognized. I had blood all over my clothes, in my face and my arms. And I asked this girl, I said, what happened last night? I don't remember anything that happened. And she told me this humiliating story about how I went to this party and I busted my face and I got in this altercation. Just all this stuff, you know. And I was like, I'm never doing that again. I'm humiliated. I can't believe I did that, you know. And I swore it off forever that I was never going to do that again. And it says in the book, we can't bring into consciousness with sufficient force the pain, the suffering, the humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We're without a defense against the first drink. I swore it off forever that I was never going to do it again. And an hour later, I got my vehicle and I said, it's going to be different this time. And I got my car and I drove away. And I went to my brother's house in Thibodaux, which is about 20 minutes away from where I grew up. And I said, Chris, man, I just need to sleep it off. I'm having a rough time. I'm tired. So he gave me a handful of sedatives. And he says, take these are going to help you sleep. And I said, okay, down the hatch. And he says, but you can't stay here after I took them. And he's like, you got to go. I got somewhere to go. And I'm like, okay. And I drove away. And I got about a mile down the road and it was either turn left or turn right or go into, we call them bayous, but I guess it would be a canal here. It was either left, right, or bayou. And I'm thinking left, but my hand and my mind aren't connecting. And I went straight. And I totaled my car. I flipped it, and I climbed out of the sunroof, soaking wet, and the first vehicle I flagged down were some off-duty firefighters, and they called the cops, like, right in. They were there within, like, 2 minutes. What are the odds? Record timing. And they were like, what happened? And obviously, they knew I was under the influence, and the cops showed up after that, and I got my first offense DWI at 16 years old. And 2 days later, I ended up in a treatment center in Opelousas, Louisiana. And treatment did what it was designed to do. It introduced me to y'all. First meeting I went to was called the Liberty Street Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Opelousas. It was an impromptu speaker meeting where somebody goes up to the podium, shares a little bit of their story, sits down, somebody else comes up. It's kind of like textbook AA that I'd seen in movies. And since my siblings were in and out of AA, I kind of heard about it, you know. And this guy was up there talking about urinating on himself and sleeping under bridges and losing his wife and his kids. And I'm like 16. I smoke a little pot. I even drink a little bit of beer. You know, like, not that bad. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. I haven't even had a legal drink. You know, all this stuff. So check, check, check. I'm trying to get out of here. And they wanted me to do 90 days. I did 30 days. And I left out of there. And I said it was the high school that I was at. And if I leave this high school and go to another high school, everything is going to be different. So I switched over to another high school. And not only did I switch high schools, but my little cousin and two other friends, they were switching schools too because they were going to change their lives as well, right? My little wolf pack just moved to a new territory is the way I like to describe that. And I don't remember my 11th and 12th grade year of high school. I gave up all extracurricular activity. I was really good at sports. I gave all that up. And I was living every day to make my hands stop shaking and not detox. I was able to graduate high school by cheating my way through. And I'm not proud to admit that. I'm a pretty bright person. But I had such a fear that if I really applied myself and I really tried and I failed, well, it was on me. But if I didn't really try and I cheated my way through and I failed, well, I really didn't try. I had all the potential in the world. But I never really amounted to everything that I was capable of. And the state of Louisiana thought better than me going to Cancun, Mexico for my senior trip and sent me to Morgan City, Louisiana instead to rehab. And I did 21 days of detox, and on the way to treatment, I needed a little relief to make it through 30-day treatment. So I snuck in some of those little small alcohol bottles and some sedatives, and it was a 28-day program, and on the 27th day, they kicked me out for talking to a female is what they said. They never caught me drinking. They never caught me doing anything else. They just kicked me out. And talking to females is what they put on paper, but the reality is I was taking up a spot for somebody that was going to die if they didn't get that bed. I see it now, you know, and I'm thankful that they did that. Maybe somebody else's life was spared as a result of that, you know. And they sent me back to this outpatient program, and they made a deal with me every Tuesday at 2 o'clock. If you don't fill a drug test or a breathalyzer test, we'll write a letter to your PO, to the judge. You'll be off of papers for the first time in like 6 years. And everything's going to be good. But if you fail one, you're going to go to a halfway house. And I made a commitment to them. But the problem is, and there's a lot of ideas or beliefs. Some say it's genetics or what. I mean, I'm not that smart. But I know for me, my alcoholism, there was a period of my life where I could stop or moderate because I loved her, she loved me, or I really wanted that job, or I really didn't want to hurt her. But then there was a period of my life whenever I crossed over this invisible line in the sand, and on the other side of that was I was a real alcoholic. And no matter how great the necessity, the wish, the consequences went over my head, even though I didn't want to do it, I had to do it. So I'd hang out with my friends on a Friday, and I'd drink a little bit of gin or a little bit of bourbon, and I'd wake up on Saturday, and I'd still be thirsty. And I keep doing it. And I failed every breath test and drug test that they gave me. This was like 3 or 4 weeks, a month's worth. And they kept giving me chance after chance. And finally, I couldn't stop. So they sent me to a halfway house in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And I was there for about a month. I met a girl in the program. What are the odds? And we ended up I ended up moving out of that halfway house. I moved in with my sponsor, his wife, and their three kids, and they were living in a three-bedroom trailer. And I'm an 18-year-old kid that they've only known for about a month, and they took me in and they let me sleep on their couch. And every night before they'd go to bed, they would hold hands as a family, and they'd say the Lord's Prayer, and their little kids would be like, keep coming back, it works if you work. Kind of like she was saying last night. It's kind of culty, but not, no. But they included me in their family, and they didn't have to do that. And I was getting intoxicated while I was under their roof, and I was hiding it, and I was lying to them. And they didn't ask me to leave their house. I left because of my conscience. I was doing that, and every night they would do that with me, you know, and I was like, I can't deal with this. So I did like any suitable alcoholic would do. I moved into the Motel 6. Right? Always keep the lights on. And I moved into this Motel 6 off of MLK in Lake Charles. I was there for probably about 3 or 4 days. I ran out of money and alcohol and all those things that made me feel okay with me. And I called my dad, and I asked him to come pick me up. He drove through the middle of the night. He drove 4 hours and came and picked me up. And while I was waiting for my dad to come, I called my sponsor. They had a landline at the time. Y'all remember those things? And his wife picked up the phone. And his wife was in the program, and she heard my voice. And she's like, Jacob, is that you? And I'm like sobbing. I'm just crying. I'm like, yeah. She's like, Jacob, did you relapse? I'm like, no. She knew the truth. I knew the truth. I was incapable of being honest. Like, I couldn't get it out. Everybody knew what time it was. I just couldn't get it out. And my dad picked me up and brought me home. And picked up right where I left off. The insanity of my alcoholism, what it looks like at the end, was Hurricane Katrina destroyed New Orleans. Like, destroyed it. And I wrote it out 60 miles southwest. Emergency response vehicles aren't on the road. Cops aren't on the roads. Paramedic, nobody's on the roads. But you know who's driving around looking for a gas station that's open? Or maybe somebody's got some beer or somebody's got some relief for me? Me. I mean, I'm a roofing contractor by trade. I work natural disasters. And I just went through 4 major hurricanes in 2 years. I know what that looks like, the devastation that it causes, and the insanity for somebody like me to be driving around in the middle of this thing. It's pretty crazy, you know? But I would go to any lengths for relief. That's all I wanted was relief, you know? Later on that year, I ended up going to a house party, and I dropped off a bunch of sedatives, and I ended up going to the movies with this girl after. And my little cousin and a bunch of friends were over there. And I got a call like 2 hours later, and it was my best friend Corey, and I just ignored his call, and he just kept calling, he kept calling. Finally, I walked out after about 20 calls, and I picked up, I'm like, what's going on, what do you want? And he told me that my aunt was at the house, and the cops were at the house, and my little cousin had overdosed, and he had passed away. He went to sleep, and he was 19 years old. And the most selfish thing in the world that I could have ever done was take full responsibility for somebody else's life. And I thought that I was that powerful. You know, doing inventory work today, I know that I'm not that powerful. I played a part, but if it wouldn't have been me, it would have been somebody else. But I wanted that. I wanted that responsibility because that's how selfish that I was, you know. I remember going to the wake and my aunt, my uncle saying, Jacob, we want to talk to you. We want to talk to you. And in my mind, they didn't want to talk to me. They wanted to blame me for everything, you know. So I stayed away. And the most hopeless feeling in the world is when you check out of these fly-by-night motel rooms, you got your garbage bags, your belongings, you're sitting on the curb, and you're like, what's my next move going to be? Like, who am I going to call? Who's going to give me a ride here? Maybe I can sleep on their couch, or I can take a shower at their house. Like, every day was just a grind to survive, pretty much, you know? And my friend Corey's mom and dad ended up taking me in and let me sleep on their couch, and I'm so thankful for them that they kept me alive long enough to get sober. Because without them, I would have died. I know that, you know. And at the end of March, we ended up going to Grand Isle, Louisiana, which is the very toe of Louisiana, the bottom toe, to a weekend trip. And they all had kids and responsibilities and jobs to get back to on Sunday, and I didn't have anything, so I just stayed in my truck and lived in my truck for about 5 days. And I ran out of money and alcohol and all those things that make me feel okay with me, and we know how the story goes, right? And I remember calling my dad, and I was like, Dad, you know, I have nowhere to go. Can you please take me in? Please help me. And I'll never forget what he said, because he had told me this a million times my whole life. And I'm sure that if you're in this room in some capacity, somebody's told you something similar to this. I love you unconditionally. Please come home. I want to take care of you. Stay sober and you can come home and I'll take care of you. Okay. And I went to his house and I threw my garbage bags in their bedroom and I said, I'm going to an AA meeting in Lockport, which is about 30 minutes away from HOMA. You might be an alcoholic if you have to lie about going to AA to go get drunk. That's what I did. He called me like an hour later. He's like, hey, where you at? And I'm like, oh, acceptance was the topic. We're going to Waffle House. We're drinking coffee. You know, all this, right? The lingo. And he's like, you're lying to me. He didn't say it that nicely. He was pretty upset. Because he went to check up on me to make sure that I was at that meeting. And I wasn't there, but who was there was my aunt, and it was a women's big book study. So he was like, look, you're lying to me, you know, expletive. Where are you? I'm coming pick you up. Your aunt wants to talk to you. Okay. So he picked me up, and he brought me back to her house. And I sat across the kitchen table from her. And my entire life I had doctors with all these degrees and all these letters behind their names saying, Jacob, you're this. Jacob, you're depressed. Jacob, you're a drug addict. You're an alcoholic. You're bipolar. You're this. You're that. But nobody ever asked me, do you think you are? And she sat across the kitchen table and she started asking me some questions on page 20 and 21, describing the non-alcoholic, the hard drinker, and the real alcoholic. And after every example that she read, I gave her a detailed account of my experience. And she gave me a detailed account of her experience, and she tricked me. She got me. She grasped my attention with depth and weight. And I was highly intoxicated at the time, but I still vaguely remember these things happening. And she, like Al-Anon, stepped my dad before I got there, because my dad's like, you're not coming home. You need to go to rehab. And I said, I've been through every treatment center in Louisiana. Nothing's going to help me. I'm unique, you know? And she said, call your cousin in Baton Rouge. She owns a treatment center. You can go there. Half my family's in recovery and half my family needs recovery. So lucky for me, my cousin's 25th sobriety date was that, like, within that week. And he was like, hey, I'm going to give you a scholarship for me being sober, you know? And he asked me, are you willing to do whatever it takes to stay sober? And I'm like, Yeah, I love sobriety, of course. You know? But in the back of my mind, I'm like, 30 days and I'm getting out of here because I don't want to be sober. Like, I have no desire to be sober. I drank all the alcohol that I had. I took all the sedatives that I had the night before. I came to in a hospital bed on Government Street in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I say April the 2nd is my sobriety date. I really don't know what my sobriety date is. I had to be medically detoxed. I'd have seizures. I just know that my brother's actual birthday is April the 1st. I really think my birthday is April 1st, but I didn't want to ruin that for him. So I just say April the 2nd to make him feel better, right? And I was there for about 3 weeks, you know, telling the counselors what I think they wanted to hear, that I had 6 months and I just slipped, and I quote the big book in like groups and tell this guy he needs to get out of their relationship because it's detrimental to sobriety and all that stuff, right? And then I had this thing called Family Day, and it's kind of like a popular TV show where your family comes in and corners you and reads this letter to you. And out of all my family, my dad was the only one that showed up. And my dad sat knee to knee, eye to eye, like here, and he read this letter to me, and he was just bawling his eyes out. And he's like, I've accepted the fact that you're going to die. You've done this over and over. You can't even make it through rehab without sneaking something in. That's how bad you are, and you can't even see it. I mean, he just gave me the truth. And it was the first time that I didn't have anything to numb that out. And I got to hear every bit of it, every word of it, you know? This is a man that whenever I had $250,000 bond, because I got set up by the state police, that he was on the other end of the phone crying to me, said he would take my place for me if he could. And I have kids today, so I understand, like, that love. And I became willing at that point not to stay sober the rest of my life or the rest of that year. I became willing at that point to do whatever it took to not hurt him anymore. And that was enough for me to make a beginning. I just didn't want to hurt him anymore. You know, I was tired of hurting him and letting him down and all that, you know. And I had nowhere to go anyways. So I ended up getting the Emperor's Package of Treatment, is what I call it. Like, I'm a high roller in Vegas. Whenever they give you those perks, and I was in treatment for like a year, and I ended up getting to this halfway house that was connected to the same treatment center, and I got a sponsor who was an atheist, and we never got on our knees and did a third-step prayer, and I did a four-step, but it was real surface, and there were certain things that I left off anyways because I can't say that out loud in the fifth step, and I didn't make amends to anybody, and I was just doing all the same behaviors without picking up the drink, and I thought about drinking every single day for 10 months. If you don't drink, everything's going to be okay. If you don't drink, everything's going to be okay, and if you're an alcoholic like I am, the time and place is going to come where you're either going to drink or you're going to kill yourself. And I was laying in a bed and in this sober living house, 10 months dry without a drop of alcohol in my body. You never had a legal drink. Maybe you can just have one drink. But if you have a drink, it's going to lead to this. Well, maybe you can smoke weed because weed comes from the earth. And just all this stuff in my mind, and it wouldn't shut up. And I was up for like a day and a half, and I had insomnia, and I was feeling pretty crazy, you know? And the next thought was, maybe you should kill yourself. And almost a year dry without a drop of alcohol in my body, wanting to die. And I was an agnostic. Agnostic means without knowledge. An atheist has logical reasoning why there's no God. Agnostic believes that there's something, they just don't know what it is. And I was an agnostic. I was more angry at God than anything. I blamed God for all my problems, but I took credit for all the good things. How funny is that, right? So I crawled out of bed, contemplating suicide, and I got on my knees. Because, like, what else am I going to do? And literally crying, whatever you are, please help me. I can't do this. Please, please help me. And I got in bed, and I went to sleep. And I woke up the next day, and I went to a beginner's meeting in Denham Springs, Louisiana. And there was a guy named Thad there. He's from Chattanooga, Tennessee, who was sleeved off with tattoos, and he rode a Harley, and he sponsored my roommate. And I walked up to him after the meeting. I said, I can quote the big book, but I've never worked the steps. I've been in and out of AA for 4 years, and I've never worked the steps. And this is the only thing that's going to work, and it's the only thing I haven't tried. Will you please help me? And he said, I'm as willing as you are. And within 3 months, we went through all 12 steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. When it said to write, we wrote. When it said to pray, we prayed. When it said to do something out the book, we did it precisely how it was outlined. And I immediately started to get some relief. Step one and step two require no action whatsoever. They require only acceptance. We accept the fact that we're alcoholic and we cannot manage our own lives. And since I'm not a very good manager of my life, something outside of me can manage my life better than I can, then we can get on with the rest of the program, right? When circumstances bring us to that point of self-destruction, then we're only willing, right? Then out, me and Thad get down on our knees, we hold hands, and we say the third step prayer. And every morning I get on my knees and I say the third step prayer. And I've been doing it ever since. On it says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as I will. Relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those that would help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And it doesn't say amen at the end of that prayer because I really don't know if it's a prayer. I think it's a declaration. We're making a declaration, right? It also goes on and says, it's better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording of the prayer is quite optional as long as we express the idea and we voice it without reservation. Whenever I say that prayer, I believe it says, help me. Help me, help me, help me. I need all the help that I can. That's why I start my day, so I can have help throughout the day. Whenever I was alone in that apartment, I was down on my knees and I was crying out for help. I wasn't overwhelmed by the presence of God. I actually felt like I was in hell. There was no burning bush or clouds opening up or harps or anything like that. I felt like I was going to die. I met God alone that night, though. I didn't realize it at the time. But I also made a decision that day. Decisions alone can avail nothing until I take action. I take a piece of paper, I roll it up, I throw it at a trash can, it rolls around the rim and it hits the ground. I'm walking away and there's a little voice inside of me telling me to do what? Pick it up, throw it away. The decision's been made. I have to go over there and grab that paper and put it in that trash can though. But I made a decision that day that I was going to do something about my problem. What was that decision going to do? Bring action the next day and me go ask that guy to sponsor me and meet with him every single week until I was worked all 12 steps out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. After that, we ended up getting in the fourth step. He outlines resentment, fear, sex. He's like, hey, man, you got a week. We're going to meet together next Saturday at 8 a.m. We're going to do that fifth step. We're going to do 5, 6, 7, 8. And we're going to outline 8 and 9. You're going to go out and make amends. I mean, this is going to be a busy Saturday for you, right? And I don't know why sponsors want to meet at like 8 a.m. with a 20-year-old, right? But he called me on Friday. He's like, hey, how's that inventory going? I was like, it's going great. He's like, really? You didn't like call me all week? You had any questions? Most of the time people have questions, you know? I was like, nah, I really didn't start it, but I'm going to crank it out tonight, you know? He's like, you ain't even got to worry about cranking it out tonight. Let's just have coffee tomorrow. Come to my house, and we're just going to talk. I was like, okay. So I went to his house at 8 a.m. and knocked on the door. He opened it up. There's the coffee going. And I look behind his shoulder, and on his table, I see a big book and a notepad. I'm like, what's up? Hey, we're going to do this work again, but you're not leaving. You're staying, and you're going to finish this. I'm going to be over here playing Xbox. You've got 4 hours to write down the most pressing problems and concerns. Okay, I'm not going anywhere, you know? And I've been that sponsor before, and I'm not proud of that, but I've been that sponsor in the past where if he wants it bad enough, he'll call me when he's ready, or he's not done yet. Or, you know, like, I've been that guy, and I'm so thankful that he wasn't that guy in that moment, that he took the time, not once but twice, to sit down with me and outline that inventory and say, no, you're not running anymore. You're going to sit down and we're going to do this today. Like today. He saved my life. It didn't take 4 hours to write down everything I've been carrying around my whole life. I knew what it was. It was always on the back of my mind. It took maybe 2 hours. I wrote it all out. We ended up talking about it. He ends up giving me a list of most glaring character traits or personality defects. And he says, these are the things that are blocking you off from a relationship with God. And if you're not connected to God, you're not connected to the world. And if you're not connected to the world, you're not connected to God. It's like the circle and triangle, right? Remove one leg from the equation, three-legged bar stool, you're going to fall. If I'm not connected to you, I don't have God, you know? He says, I want you to go home. I want you to find a place to be quiet for an hour. I want you to carefully review everything that we've talked about. I want you to thank God. I want you to pray. And there's some questions that I want you to ask yourself. Is the work that you've done up to this point solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Stones? What are you talking? And then he goes back and he outlines it on step two. It talks about stones in step two and step three. On step two, it says, there you are. We need to ask ourselves but one short question. If you're new here, we're going to take the second step. Do you now believe, are you even willing to believe that there's a power greater than yourself? It's a yes or a no question. Do you believe that you're God? No, obviously. That's ridiculous. Okay, well, stop playing God. If you believe that you're not God, you believe something outside of you has more power than you have. I can work with that. Okay. It says, as soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically, I love that word, emphatically assure him that he is on his way. It's been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderful, effective spiritual structure can be built. The spiritual structure that we're building is an arch. It's an arch called freedom. You can't build the arch without laying the first stone, which is what? The cornerstone. Step two is the cornerstone. Well, there's two cornerstones to the arch because you can't start on one side and end on the other. You have to start on each side and meet in the middle. So what's the other cornerstone? A, that we're alcoholics, we cannot manage our own lives, step one. And step two is the other cornerstone, step one and step two. And then we can start building it up. Acceptance, not action. And then we get into step three. It says, this is the how and why of it. God was going to be our director. He is the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, we are his children. It's been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, It says, there it is. This is how and why, first of all, we had to quit blaming God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal, we're his agents. He is the father, we're his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of new and triumphant arch to which we shall pass to freedom. So if we're building an arch called freedom, the keystone is the last stone that you lay. It bridges the gap. It's the strongest part of any arch that you have. Because without that keystone, what happens is it falls, it crumbles, right? So are the stones properly in place up to this point? Yes. And if I can answer my satisfaction, I look to step six where I have a list of character defects or personality traits. And some of them are removed right away because I can see the pain that it's caused in step four. But some of them I want to hang on to a little bit more closely because I get a sense of satisfaction or well-being from it. I become willing to let go of those whenever I go out and I make amends. Because 9 times out of 10, the unexpected happens in those amends process. Pay me back the money, keep doing what you're doing. I forgive you, but 1 time out of 10, they're going to tell me where to go. Right? And that's where I learn, and that's where I grow from it. And after it's all said and done, I want you to get down on your knees. I want you to say the 7-step prayer. My Creator, I'm now willing you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. Amen. Thank you and help you. Thank you and help you. Then we get a list of people that we hurt, right? Because if you stepped on my toes in the resentment list, I stepped on your foot and I retaliated. I was going to get you back, but better. I had a spiritual experience in 3, 4, 5. I had an awakening in step 8 and step 9 because this word, I found out that there was a God out there and you did want to do business. I wanted to do business with him. A couple of the amends that I got the opportunity to make was type of alcoholic that I was. I was 18 years old. I was going to Mardi Gras in New Orleans. I didn't have enough money to go to Mardi Gras in New Orleans. And I walked into a gas station, and whenever she, the lady, I asked for something behind the counter, when she turned her back, I stole a donation thing for an organization that really needed that money. And it wasn't $1 million, but it was enough money for me to do whatever I needed to do that day. I'm not proud of it, but that's what I did. And it was about 2 years sober, and I remembered that. And I wrote it all down on paper, and I called my sponsor. I said, this is what happened. I need to make amends for this. He says, well, how are you going to make amends for that? I said, well, I'm going to make an anonymous donation in a gas station and a little can thing. And he says, well, how you, let me know how that works out for you. You didn't harm that can. You harmed those people. You harmed that institution. I said, okay. So I called him back the next day. I said, hey, I got an idea. I'm going to write a letter. I'm going to admit my wrong in this letter to that institution, but I'm just going to put Jacob B. without any return address. He's like, well, how are you going to know if the amends was made? Let me know how that works out for you. And you remember those old Wile E. Coyote Roadrunner cartoons when the coyote would get an idea to catch the Roadrunner and this light bulb would go off over his head? That's what an intuitive thought looks like to me. I literally get to the mailbox. Every idea, every intention of this is what I'm going to do, and this light bulb goes off over my head that I need to make sure this is made. It says we decide to go to any length to find a spiritual experience. And this isn't a nice step. So we ask that we be given the strength and the direction to do the right thing no matter what the personal consequences might be. I need to make sure this is made. I need freedom. Because the spiritual experience that I had last month, last week, last year is not sufficient to keep me sober today. So I mailed it off and I get a letter back a week later. I call my sponsor. I was like, I got a letter back. I don't know what to do. He's like, read the letter. It says, Jacob, thank you for your honesty and your willingness to correct your wrongdoing. The money that you donated will be used to assist the hundreds of local families that we serve. Again, thank you for your honesty and your willingness. God bless you. And the director ended up signing it for the Muscular Dystrophy Association. And I think back to if I wouldn't have put my name and my address on that letter, I might not be sober today. You might have a different speaker today. The impact on my life that it had was sudden and profound, like the big book described. And not only was I was able to forgive myself, but I was able to forgive other people for the things that they had done to me as a result of that, you know? And I talked with Brandon about that, about a guy that had sponsored me before, like literally within the past week. He reached out to me, and 15 years ago, he harmed me. 15 years it took him to make an amends. And I said, just do me a favor to make this right. If anybody ever cares about you, please don't wait 15 years to make an amends to them, because they genuinely do care about you still, you know? And it's true. My heart was softened as a result of that. Another amends that I got to make was to my aunt Donna, my little cousin's mother. I was 2 years sober, and I avoided it for the first 2 years of my sobriety. I was scared. And I remember getting a phone call from my brother, and he said, hey, I saw your aunt Donna at the mall. She knows you're sober. She wants to talk to you. And you need to give her a call. So I prayed for about a week for willingness to call her, to have the courage to call her. And whenever I finally called her, I heard her voice. I broke down and cried. I just cried. And I said, I can never give you your son back. This is the part that I played. This is what happened that night. You have every right to know that because he's your son. And I can't give his life back to you. But whatever I could do to make it right, please make me aware of it. And she said, I love you unconditionally no matter what, and we didn't want to blame you for anything. We wanted to tell you we were going to end up just like Nicholas if you didn't stop the things that you were doing. And I love you. And we mended that relationship, and we built that relationship. And I ended up getting a call about 11 years ago. And it was the day before Mother's Day. It was from my mom. And she told me that my aunt Donna had got diagnosed with cancer, with colon cancer. And so I drove down on Mother's Day and I sat with my aunt Donna and I cooked for her and I prayed with her and I held her hand and we just spent time together, you know. And she ended up doing chemo and taking fighting the cancer as long as she could. And I got a call about a week before Christmas of that year that she wasn't going to make it through the night. So I drove down there and I walked into the house that my grandfather had built. She was in a hospice bed in a corner. Her two daughters were next to her. She had some close friends in the room, and I got down on my knees and I held her hand for about 4 hours until my other aunt got in from Missouri. And whenever my other aunt got in, they asked all non-immediate family to leave the room so that she was passing. And I got up to leave, and they told me not to move, to stay right where I was. And I got to be present with her when she passed away, which is an honor in itself. And I remember driving back to Baton Rouge, and the sun was just starting to come up over the swamp. And I was sitting in complete silence. And I remember my old grand sponsor, a guy named Irvin, telling me, "You'll never know when you have the opportunity to make an amends that you never thought you can make as long as you remain open to it. But the problem is I've got these blinders on like a horse in the French Quarter. And I can't see what's out here. All I can see is me. And whenever I take these blinders off, a whole new view comes into play, right?" And it finally hit me that I got to be there in my cousin's place whenever his mom passed away. Like, it was done. The amends was made. We're good. We're whole, you know. They asked me to do the eulogy at her funeral, which was an honor in itself. And before I got up there, her best friend came up and she was crying, just hugging me. And she says, "You have no idea of how proud your aunt was of you." And she started to tell me a story about how my aunt saw me come and pick up my two-year chip at that meeting I lied about going to that my aunt was at. You remember that? I picked up my two-year chip. They invited me to tell my story and pick up my two-year chip. And my Aunt Donna had came and supported me to see that. And she says, "You know, when your aunt went and saw you and she saw the man that you had become up there, she was able to have closure on her son's death." Like, we might not want the responsibility, but people watch us. Like, we're an instrument of God, you know? And she was buried 7 years to the day that her son passed away. And there's no flimsy read or coincidence in that. Like, she's truly at home with her son. And that's what I said in the eulogy, you know? Step 10, 11, and 12 are the maintenance steps of the program. I say that all the time. You know, I continue to go through the day. I look for selfish, self-seeking, dishonesty, fear. When they crop up, I talk to someone immediately. I make amends as quickly as I can. And I resolutely turn my thought to someone else that I can help. Every morning, like I said, I'm a roofing contractor. I start my day very, very early. I watch the sun rise over the Atchafalaya Basin over the swamp. I sit in complete silence for the first 40 minutes of my drive. After the first 40 minutes of my drive, I usually put on some type of inspiration to kind of get me motivated for the rest of the day for about another 45 minutes. And then I can go throughout my day and I can be more useful to other people and I can be more open with other people. Every night whenever I get home, I put my two boys to sleep. It's very important that I do that every night. We read some literature for them to grow spiritually as well as myself. And after they go to sleep, I have a really nice greenhouse. I'm a gardener. And I go into my cypress wood greenhouse and I sit quietly in there and I plant vegetable seed. Like, it's spring in Louisiana right now. It's like 80 degrees. It's snow out my window over here, which is like I've seen snow 5 times. But it's definitely spring in Louisiana. All my stuff's growing. So I sit in my greenhouse and I just sit quietly and plant seeds. And we're gonna till up the yard next week and me and my boys are gonna start planting all of our vegetables, and you know. But that's where I find my meditation. And I also, my guys that I sponsor, I have two guys that I sponsor in Louisiana and my guy in Oklahoma, and we have an accountability text that every night we do a guided meditation with an app on the phone. It asks some questions, it goes throughout the day, and we share that with each other. And usually if I'm putting down I'm selfish multiple times in a row, I need to take a look at that and maybe get some guidance on how to correct that behavior, right? And we go over it, and it's complete accountability, and it's guided. And so step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, we've gone through the 12 steps. I've had a psychic change, but I have to continue to carry the message in order to continue to grow and have the psychic change. And I got the opportunity. I was the Area 27 Corrections Chair. Area 27 is Louisiana. Y'all are 26. We're 27. We're pretty much neighbors, right? And the oldest AA meeting, registered meeting in Louisiana is the sober group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Angola, Louisiana. It's inside the main prison of Angola, state penitentiary. And I got a call from Camp C, which is short time, 15 years of time or less, that they were looking for some literature, the social worker. So I was like, I need to get in there because we weren't present in bringing outside AA in for 10 years. Something happened. And I went in there and I met with them and I had a date and a time set up next Sunday, 7 o'clock. We're going to have a small group, get this thing started. Then my dad got sick. And my dad was in the hospital for like 9 days and his organs shut down one by one. He ended up passing away. I was holding him and my two brothers were holding us. It was beautiful. You know, I got to be present with my best friend when he passed away. And I remember my uncle grabbing me, who was right next to me. My uncle did not cry. And he hugged me and he looked at me crying. He says, you have no idea of how proud your dad would be of you in this moment. I would give up every material possession just for my dad to be proud. For me, the man that he knew I could be in that moment. Because every inventory that my dad died. And to be faced with it, it was a blessing. So I had 2 weeks of that meeting, so we never got it started. Well, I'm only there. It's an hour and a half drive back to Angola from Baton Rouge, and I'm talking to my co-chair in New Orleans. I'm like, man, I really need this. Like, it's perfect timing, you know. And he says, man, I got a sponsee that took his time a year sober. He's got like a year and a half or almost 2 years. There's no meetings where he's at over there. He's reading his big book. That's the only meeting that he has. Maybe you'll bump into him. I'm like, yeah, right. It's like 10,000 inmates there, you know? God's sneaky. So I go in. There were 13 inmates. 8 of them had never been to an AA meeting before in their life. I had a bunch of literature donated from the different districts. So we did like big book 101, you know, the disease concept, the obsession, you know, that good first step stuff. And after it was all said and done, I'm shaking the guy's hands and talking to him. The last guy comes up. He's like, man, I really like how you broke the book down. It reminded me of my sponsor. I'm like, sponsor? Where are you from? Oh, I'm from New Orleans. I said, really? Who's your sponsor? He said, Ben. I was like, your name's Earl. Like, I gave him all this information that about him that he was like shook. And I was like, no, dude, I've been talking about you for like a while. And he's like, the only thing that says I'm locked up are the bars and these windows. Other than that, I'm a free man. I'm freer than I've ever been in my entire life, and I want these other guys to have what I got. And I was like, well, I don't know if these other 12 guys need a meeting, but I know he needs a meeting. So I made a commitment to Earl that I'm going every week, every Sunday, I'm going, and we're gonna have a meeting. And if other people want to come hang out, that's cool too. So we ended up getting 20 members. We registered the group with GSO, another chance group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Camp C, got the penitentiary big book, and they still meet at 7 o'clock. And from those 20 guys, as a group, every week, we read the book, and when it said to write, we wrote. I went over there on a weekend and listened to Fifth Steps the entire weekend. I had a garbage bag. After they were done doing their Fifth Steps, I tore them up. I put them in the trash bag. I brought them off site, and I burned it. We prayed. We held hands and did the third step prayer as a group of inmates and me. I wrote my fourth step on a dry erase board. That's why I said I had no secrets. I mean, everybody knows my secrets. I drew it all out. His society outline, resentment, fear, sex, you know. I gave him my experience. And after it was all said and done, they went back. I ended up cooking gumbo and potato salad and all that stuff. I got to cook for them. It was pretty cool. And then they went back and they got 20 more inmates, and it was their group because I moved to New Orleans, and that group's still going on now. And Earl got released early in his sentence. He's a productive member of society in New Orleans. Another guy named Mr. Oliver got released after 48 years of being incarcerated. He too is a productive member of society, and both of them are still sober and going strong, you know. It says in the book, we have to find a power by which we can live, and it has to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously, but where and how we're going to find that power. And it says, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. So if God's right there within me, God's right there within you. I have to get out of myself long enough to help you in order to experience the presence of something greater than me. Trying to explain God is like trying to explain the sin of a rose. You can't explain the sin of a rose. You experience the sin of a rose, and it's the same thing. So thank y'all so much for having me, and I appreciate it. Thank you.